Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who like books. My name is Heather Wardover, and I'm podcasting from my corner of the Sonoran Desert, the Old Pueblo, Tucson, Arizona. Episode 72, Just Weave It. This episode of Craftlit is brought to you by Knitting Out Loud, knitting audiobooks. Listen while you knit. Well, hello, all of you. I am still sick, and I imagine I will break into massive fits of coughing, which I will then have to edit out to save your poor eardrums for those of you who listen on a headset. I generally, when I get a cold, it goes from my head into my lungs, and I can feel that process already starting. In fact, tonight I think I'm going to go breathe some heavy-duty steam. I used to have eucalyptus oil for exactly this purpose, and I am going to attempt something similar to that tonight. But it's been a good week, in spite of all the sickness and stuff. I made myself a giant pot of matzo ball soup, and it is Jewish penicillin. There are actually doctors who tell you, at least in New York, if you're sick, get yourself some good chicken soup, because there's something about chicken soup that is actually very good for you. So I'm going to go and have a little bit more of that, I think, later tonight. It always perks me up. And we've got three really good chapters for you tonight. One of them is very short, and again, another setup, but we're getting very close to the end. And in fact, next week, I am just going to shove through, and we will finish Tristan and Isolde next week. Then following week, I go to Soar. And yes, I have started packing, and I'm actually feeling a little naked right now, because I have shipped my wheel. So I am living in a home without a wheel. However, that will soon rectify itself, because I have made a trade with one of our listeners, Erin. She had a wheel she wanted to get rid of. I had some fiber I wanted to get rid of, and it was a match made in heaven. Very excited about that. So Erin and I have done that. Erin was crestfallen that she was not the first person to tell me that the movie's title was The Secret of Rowan Inish. But in the process of being crestfallen, she looked up what the term crestfallen meant and found out, and she's right, she is the first person to ever have told me this, that the term crestfallen comes from the Muscovy duck, who has a crest which goes up when it is excited and visibly falls after it is excited, or after it's done being excited. And therein lies the impetus for the term crestfallen. So Erin did actually get through with that one first, because I don't know that anyone else was trying to get through to me with that one. But it's always good to learn new terms, especially since I haven't been able to get back to the OED. They've closed the Poetry Center here for a retrofit or a refit. They're building a new Poetry Center building, and the opening will happen while I'm at SOAR, but I think I'm going to require my little freshman to go over and take a look at it and hunt down the OED and look up their favorite word, and that's how I'll be able to tell if they actually made it there or not. That's my goal. I wanted to also remind you that we have our incentives still going on for the month of September. If you, we have 4 more days of September. If you donate to Craftlit during the month of September, there is sock yarn that potentially has your name on it, and there is a charm from our artist Jen Minnis. The sock yarn is from our friend Cheeky Redhead, who, if you are on Ravelry, you can find her under that name. And our friend Jen Minnis, who we have a button to on the show notes, so you can take a look at some of Jen's other art. Her charms are really quite spectacular. So if you feel like making a donation, please do, and know that you will be put into the drawing for those two fabulous gifts donated by our spectacular listeners. And more, I'm just realizing that our listeners are, well, frankly, the best people on the planet. The more of you who contact me, the more I am absolutely positive about that. And the more of you who contact me, the more absolutely positive I am about the fact that you would all love the latest Thursday Next book, the first among sequels. I know I've talked about Thursday Next before, and I've gotten this radical idea in my mind that at some point I am, in fact, going to try and track down Jasper Ford and interview him for the podcast. I haven't actually worked up the guts to do it yet, but it's going to happen. I know it will. There will come a day when I just lose all shame and prostrate myself on the altar of Jasper Ford. It's going to happen. And in that same vein, I have decided that this year at SOAR, I am not going to be shy. This year at SOAR, I am going to take my little handheld recording device, and I am going to walk up to the likes of Stephanie Pearl McPhee and Nancy Bush and Morgaine from Carolina Homespun and Tony from The Fold, and I'm just going to interview these people and find out what they like to read and find out if they listen, and if they don't listen, find out why. My husband recommended that I get a bunch of copies of Frankenstein from the used bookstore here and put a label on them to say, you know, listen to Craftlit if you've never read the book, or if you have and think you know it, because Frankenstein comes next. And I do think I will do a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit of romantic poetry before we head into Frankenstein hardcore. Maybe I can intersperse interviews with romantic poetry for the week that I'm at SOAR, and then we'll launch into the heavy-duty text itself. Actually, that kind of sounds fun. I think I'll do that. So, Thursday Next, Jasper Ford interviewing people. And in the middle of all this, you're saying, yes, but why did she title this podcast Just Weave It? Well, I'll tell you. It's because on eBay, I finally managed to score a Weave It, or a Weavette, depending on who made it, when it was made, and how it's spelled. And I think it's spelled differently depending on either who was making it or when it was made. Since I don't have two to compare, I can't tell you for sure. I'm sure somebody out there knows, though, and please email me and let me know. Either way, if you are someone who takes spinoff, you'll remember about a year and a half ago, there was a picture of a gray and black handbag, very similar to the one on the Mason-Dixon Knitting website, the Mason-Dixon Knitting blog website. And there was a flower, a beautiful little woven flower that was on this hand-spun felted bag on the cover of Spinoff. And those flowers were made with a weavette. It took me a while to figure out that a weavette is not just a normal weaving loom. And in fact, I am starting to warp this little handheld weaving loom, and I'm really impressed. It creates a very dense, it's not dense though. It's dense in that it's well looped and that it's not going to unravel, but it's not dense in that you can't see through the fabric. You can see through the fabric as long as you don't use like chunky weight yarn, which honestly, I don't think I could fit through the pins. But these tiny little weaving looms go for a fortune on eBay. If you are not the fastest person or lucky enough to sneak in under the wire, you either will get into a bidding frenzy with someone somewhere, or you'll wind up, you know, bidding at the last minute and going crazy and bidding $25 or $30 for a little 3-inch loom. I was lucky and got in under the wire. And I think in my trade with Aaron, I also scored one. This all happened at the same time. I actually talked to Aaron and then found out that I won the other one on eBay yesterday. So I'm very excited. And I'm going to go use it tonight. And if any of you are part of the cult of the Weavette and have any useful things to tell me, words of wisdom, guidance, warnings, please feel free to contact me at mamaoknits@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. I also wanted to let you know that we have a new t-shirt possibility. Aaron and Heidi and Jen and I are all talking back and forth about a new Hot Men of Craftlit t-shirt. And Heidi's idea was not Hot H-O-T, but Hot H-A-U-T-E. Men of Craftlit. We're working on it. We'll see. If it works out, it's going to be bloody brilliant, and I'm going to buy one for everyone I know, and I hope you will too. But we'll do that again through Cafe Press, so they'll be easy to get for anyone who wants them. I have finished a pair of socks in less than a week, and I am really, really proud of myself. This was social obligation knitting, but it was social obligation knitting of the best kind. It was a pair of socks that I had been wanting to make for my stepmom. They're Harry Potter socks, those Horcrux socks that the Six Socks Knit Along invented a couple of socks ago. And it's a wonderful little pattern. If you're not in the Six Socks Knit Along, it's free. You may as well join. The patterns have been spectacular in the year since I joined after finding out about them from my friend at SOAR last year. And the Horcrux sock, for some reason, seems to be one of the fastest sock patterns I've ever been able to knit. And I think they're really handsome looking, too. So that's, you know, it's nice. You wind up with a fast project and something that looks good at the end. And it made my stepmom very happy, so I was very glad about that. And I have now been able to go back to the knitting portion of the hand-spun baby hoodie for Jessica, for baby Jessica. I have not gotten around to the felting part. I'm still a little frightened. But next week I should be able to report to you about all of this, because I had better be done with that sweater by next week, and felted as well. One of the problems with doing all of this crafty stuff right now is that I'm in the middle of grading essays for my freshman comp class at the U of A. And they're very sweet kids, and I'm finally starting to get to know them, and it's brutal. You know, in high school you get to know the kids very quickly and very well very quickly. And at college, I see them twice a week and only for an hour and a half, and they're all terrified, and so they don't talk much. And they're only just starting to speak up in class and have a sense of humor and share ideas. And they're still pretty scared, but we're getting there. But I am grading their essays, and I have a rubric that I have to use. So there's very, very little leeway for me. You know, either they have a succinct, clear, supported thesis statement, or they don't. And if they have that, that's a C. If they have more than that, you know, well-supported paragraphs, or they cite stuff, or it's kind of inspirational, then it goes up in grade. But I've never given out so many C's and D's. You know, a vague thesis statement, even if you prove it well, a vague thesis statement is a D. So I brutalized some kids today, and I felt very bad. But I have office hours, and I'm conferencing with all of them personally next week, because I have to cancel the classes while I'm at SOAR. So I'm going to be able to sit down and talk to them all individually, one-on-one, and I hope I can, you know, repair their fragile egos and help them understand what they need to do for their writing. Because really, they're bright kids. They had good ideas. They just can't seem to construct those ideas meaningfully with words on paper. So we're working on it. But it's always hard. And grading essays takes forever. Especially the bad ones. I literally spent 2.5 hours on one essay, and it's painful. You know, it hurts. You want them to do so well, and then you get this stuff and go, oh dear. So we'll see. Maybe their second essays will be better. I haven't quite figured out exactly what I want to do for their second essay. I'm working on it, and in fact, I need to write some notes for myself tonight, because I'm percolating, and I need to upload that essay assignment sheet for them pretty soon. Like, half an hour ago. So there we have it. That's my life in a nutshell. I've been spinning, I've been knitting, I've been sketching still. It's coming along. I'm taking my sketching stuff with me to SOAR. And by the way, if you listen to the podcast and you are going to SOAR, please don't be shy. I think I said this last week. I'm saying it again. Please don't be shy. Come up and introduce yourself. It would be a shame for me to find out later that you'd been there and didn't say anything. I would, in fact, feel really bad, because I'd feel like I scared you off without meaning to. You probably will be able to recognize me. I will have a Craftlit t-shirt on at some point, but I think there have been enough pictures of me on the early podcast that you could probably pick me out of a crowd if I was in a lineup. So I hope to meet you there. I would really like that. Today, I want to try and get through 3 chapters, so I'm not going to dither any longer. Our first chapter is called The Ordeal by Iron, and for any of you who have seen Monty Python and the Holy Grail, There is a moment in here that will make you laugh out loud. Actually, there are a couple of moments tonight that will make you laugh out loud if you like that movie, because the word Samite comes up a couple of times, and all I can think of is the speech about the lady in the lake. And if you've seen the Holy Grail on stage, Spamalot, then it just brings up a whole different layer of fun. And if you were lucky enough to see Sarah Ramirez, who is on Grey's Anatomy now, as the Lady of the Lake in Spamalot, and you lucky people know who you are, then you get a whole third, a tertiary layer of fun. If you missed it, you should know Sarah Ramirez, who is on Grey's Anatomy, that girl can sing. And if you haven't heard her sing, go onto iTunes and listen to whatever you can listen to on their little 30-second blips of one of the Lady of the Lake songs from Spamalot. She will blow your mind. She is such a talented woman. All right, enough of my advertisement for Sarah Ramirez. So tonight, in The Ordeal by Iron, yes, you will giggle if you are a fan of the Holy Grail, Monty Python and the Holy Grail, but even if you are going to be shocked by a couple of things with this first episode. First, that people ever considered this to be a rational course of action still to this day blows my mind. The first play I was ever in at UCLA was called Witch Burning, and it was all about the burning times when women who were, you know, mostly just midwives or herbalists were accused of being witches and were summarily burned or hung or thrown off cliffs, depending on what part of the world you were in. I know one of the statistics we read was that there were, and I think I actually mentioned this before, that there were two villages in Germany that had about 3,000 people total between the two villages, and the Inquisition came through burning witches, and at the end of it, there were, they had dropped their population by half. They had killed off enough women to have dropped their population by almost half. The burning times were not good times for women. And you will hear some of the repercussions of, or actually not that, the foreshadowing of that coming in tonight's first chapter of Tristan and Isolde. The other thing that will surprise you is how bloody smart Isolde is. You're not going to understand why she is telling Tristan to do what she tells him to do until later. But trust me, she's very, very, very bright. It's not a particularly long chapter. It's not even quite 10 minutes. So with that, I am going to start for you The Ordeal by Iron.
De Nolan, Andret, and Gondorin held themselves safe. Tristan was far over sea, far away in service of a distant king, and they beyond his power. Therefore, during a hunt one day, as the king rode apart in a glade where the pack would pass, and hearkening to the hounds, they all three rode towards him and said, "O king, we have somewhat to say. Once you condemned the queen without judgment, and that was wrong. Now you acquit her without judgment, and that is wrong. She is not quit by trial, and the barons of your land blame you both. Counsel her then to claim the ordeal in God's judgment, for since she is innocent, she may swear on the relics of the saints, and hot iron will not hurt her. For so custom runs, and in this easy way are doubts dissolved." But Mark answered, "God strike you, my Cornish lords, how you hunt my shame! For you I have exiled my nephew, and now what would you now? Would you have me drive the queen to Ireland too? What novel plaints have you to plead? Did not Tristan offer you battle in this matter? He offered battle to clear the queen for ever. He offered, and you heard him all. Where then were your lances and your shields?" "Sire," they said, "we have counselled you loyal counsel as lieges, and to your honour, henceforward we hold our peace. Put aside your anger and give us your safeguard." But Mark stood up in the stirrup and cried, "Out of my land and out of my peace, all of you! Tristan I exiled for you, and now go you in turn, out of my land." But they answered, "Sire, it is well. Our keeps are strong and fenced, and stand on rocks not easy for men to climb." And they rode off without a salutation. But the king, not tarrying for huntsman or for hound, but straightway spurred his horse to Tintagel, and as he sprang up the stairs, the queen heard the jangle of his spurs upon the stones. She rose to meet him, and took his sword as she was wont, and bowed before him, as it was also her wont to do. But Mark raised her, holding her hands, and when Iseult looked up she saw his noble face in just that wrath she had seen before the faggot fire. She thought that Tristan was found, and her heart grew cold, and without a word she fell at the king's feet. He took her in his arms and kissed her gently till she could speak again, and then he said, "Friend, friend, what evil tries you?" "Sire, I am afraid, for I have seen your anger." "Yes, I was angered at the hunt." "My lord, should one take so deeply the mischances of a game?" Mark smiled and said, "No, friend, no chance of hunting vexed me, but those three felons whom you know, and I have driven them forth from my land." "Sire, what did they say, or dare to say of me?" "What matter? I have driven them forth." "Sire, all living have this right, to say the word they have conceived, and I would ask a question, but from whom shall I learn save from you? I am alone in a foreign land, and have no one else to defend me." "They would have it that you should quit yourself by solemn oath, and by the ordeal of iron, saying that God was a true judge, and that as the queen was innocent, she herself should seek judgment as would clear her for ever. This was their clamour, and their demand incessantly. But let us leave it. I tell you I have driven them forth." Iseult trembled, but looking straight at the king she said, "Sire, call them back. I will clear myself by oath, but I bargain this, that on the appointed day you call King Arthur and Lord Gawain, Girflet, Kay the Seneschal, and 100 of his knights to ride to the sandy heath where your land marches with his, and a river flows between. For I will not swear before your barons alone, lest they should demand some new thing, and lest there should be no end to my trials. But if my warrantors, King Arthur and his knights, be there, the barons will not dare dispute the judgment." But as the heralds rode to Cadriel, Iseult sent to Tristan secretly her squire Perinus, and he ran through the underwood, avoiding paths, till he found the hut of Ori, the woodman, where Tristan for many days had awaited news. Perinus told him all, the ordeal, the place, and the time, and added, "My lord, the queen would have you on that day and place come dressed as a pilgrim, so that none may know you, unarmed, so that none may challenge, to the sandy heath. She must cross the river to the place appointed. Beyond it, where Arthur and his 100 knights will stand, be you also, for my lady fears the judgment, but she trusts in God." Then Tristan answered, "Go back, friend Perinus, return you to the queen, and say that I will do her bidding." And you must know that as Perinus went back to Tintagel, he caught sight of that same woodman who had betrayed the lovers before, and the woodman, as he found him, had just dug a pitfall for wolves and for wild boars, and covered it with leafy branches to hide it. And as Perinus came near, the woodman fled, but Perinus drove him and caught him, and broke his staff and his head together, and pushed his body into the pitfall with his feet. On the appointed day King Mark and Iseult and the barons of Cornwall stood by the river, and the knights of Arthur and all their host were arrayed beyond. And just before them, sitting on the shore, was a poor pilgrim, wrapped in cloak and hood, who held his wooden platter and begged alms. Now as the Cornish boats came to the shoal of the further bank, Iseult said to the knights, "My lord, how shall I land without befouling my clothes in the river mud? Fetch me a ferryman." And one of the knights hailed the pilgrim and said, "Friend, truss your coat and try the water. Carry you the queen to shore, unless you fear the burden." But as he took the queen in his arms, she whispered to him, "Friend." And then she whispered to him lower still, "Stumble you upon the sand." And as he touched shore, he stumbled, holding the queen in his arms, and the squires and boatmen with their oars and boat-hooks drove the poor pilgrim away. But the queen said, "Let him be, some great travail and journey has weakened him." And she threw to the pilgrim a little clasp of gold. Before the tent of King Arthur was spread a rich Nicene cloth upon the grass, and the holy relics were set on it, taken out of their covers and their shrines. And round the holy relics on the sward stood a guard more than a king's guard, for Lord Gawain, Girflet, and Kay the Seneschal kept ward over them. The queen, having prayed God, took off the jewels from her neck and hands, and gave them to the beggars around, She took off her purple mantle and her overdress, and her shoes with their precious stones, and gave them also to the poor that loved her. She kept upon her only the sleeveless tunic, and then with arms and feet quite bare, she came between the two kings, and all around the barons watched her in silence, and some wept, for near the holy relics was a brazier burning. And trembling a little, she stretched her right hand towards the bones and said, King of Logres and of Cornwall, my lords Gawain and Kay and Girflet, and all of you that are my warrantors, by these holy things and all the holy things of earth, I swear that no man has held me in his arms, saving King Mark, my lord, and that poor pilgrim. King Mark, will that oath stand? Yes, queen, he said, and God see to it. Amen, said Isoult, and then she went near the brazier, pale and stumbling, and all were silent. The iron was red, but she thrust her bare arms among the coals and seized it, and bearing it, took 9 steps. Then, as she cast it from her, she stretched her arms out in a cross, with the palms of her hands wide open, and all men saw them fresh and clean and cold. Seeing that great sight, the kings and the barons and the people stood for a moment silent. Then they stirred together, and they praised God loudly all around. End of The Ordeal by Iron. End of Part the Second.
I don't know how people got into their heads that doing something like this could prove your innocence, but they did, and they did for a really long time. But we almost have stopped doing this. Mostly. Oh, my goodness. So, that was The Ordeal by Iron, and thank goodness Isoult had Tristan carry her across the river, the stream, so that she could say that the only person who had held her in his arms was Mark, and, oh, by the way, that guy who carried me across the stream. Brilliant. Brilliant. She has been a smart cookie a number of times, and that is, I think, particularly cool, especially when you're looking at a story that is as old as this one. Tough women, you know, it's something that struck me when I was studying film, too, is that we tend to think that strong women were invented in the 70s with the whole women's movement and everything. And, of course, it's completely untrue. If you go back and look at movies from the 30s and 40s, Anything before the post-war boom, you see incredibly strong women. In fact, go watch the movie The Women, or go watch His Girl Friday, or Bringing Up Baby, or anything Katharine Hepburn was ever in, or Betty Davis, or Joan Crawford, or Rosalind Russell. This whole idea or Marlene Dietrich, weak women only came in with hobble skirts and petticoats, and it was definitely at least it seems to me that it was definitely a reaction to the post-war era where the men were coming home and women had been doing men's jobs and men kind of had to reassert their position in society. And of course, I think psychologically for the men who'd been fighting, that was probably really important to have a reason to get up in the morning after going through something as horrific as war. And for those of you who are watching the war, the Ken Burns series, which just started, I'm sure you are seeing the same things we're seeing. And for those of you who've been watching Mad Men on American Movie Classics, I know I've mentioned this before, but the main character was a vet in Korea, and his boss was someone who was in World War II. And it's very interesting, the dynamic that they're portraying in these men. Very different from what happened in the country after Vietnam, and certainly very different for what's happened with the two Gulf Wars. So it is interesting how all these things had effects on women, and the latest wars, I think it's going to take us some time to see what the effect is on women, because of course this time the effect on women will be the effect on the women who served instead of the women who were left behind. We haven't been left behind in the numbers that we were left behind in World War II or even in Vietnam. Anyway, I don't know where that came from, but there it was. The next chapter tonight, the first part of book the third, is The Little Fairy Bell. And this is another one of those setup chapters. It will feel like it doesn't really matter until we get to the third chapter for this evening. There isn't a whole lot to say except that the world of fairy does show up quite a bit in some of these old stories. It's certainly prevalent in the Arthurian legends, in many of the versions, even modern versions of the Arthurian legends, the world of fairy shows up pretty prominently. And it's showing up here as well, which I think just speaks to the fact that it was so common back then. So here comes our next chapter, The Little Fairy Bell.
Part the third, The Little Fairy Bell. When Tristan had come back to Ori's hut and had loosened his heavy pilgrim's cape, he saw clearly in his heart that it was time to keep his oath to King Mark and to fly the land. 3 days yet he tarried, because he could not drag himself away from that earth. But on the fourth day he thanked the woodman and said to Gorvenal, "Master, the hour is come." And he went into Wales, into the land of the great Duke Gilain, who was young, powerful, and frank in spirit, and welcomed him nobly as a God-sent guest. And he did everything to give him honour and joy, but he found that neither adventure nor feast could soothe what Tristan suffered. One day, as he sat by the young duke's side, his spirit weighed upon him, so that not knowing it he groaned, and the duke, to soothe him, ordered into his private room a fairy thing, which pleased his eyes when he was sad, and relieved his own heart. It was a dog, and the varlets brought it into him, and they put it upon a table there. Now this dog was a fairy dog, and came from the Duke of Avalon, for a fairy had given it him as a love gift, and no one can well describe its kind or beauty. And it bore at its neck, hung to a little chain of gold, a little bell, and that tinkled so gaily, and so clear and so soft, that as Tristan heard it he was soothed, and his anguish melted away, and he forgot all that he had suffered for the queen. For such was the virtue of the bell, and such its property, that whosoever heard it, he lost all pain. And as Tristan stroked the little fairy thing, the dog that took away his sorrow, he saw how delicate it was and fine, and how it had soft hair like samite, and he thought how good a gift it would make for the queen. But he dared not ask for it right out, since he knew that the duke loved this dog beyond everything in the world, and would yield it to no prayers, nor to wealth, nor to wile. So one day Tristan, having made a plan in his mind, said this: "Lord, what would you give to the man who could rid your land of the hairy giant Urgan that levies such a toll? Truly the victor might choose what he would, but none will dare." Then said Tristan, "Those are strange words, for good comes to no land save by risk and daring, and not for all the gold of Milan would I renounce my desire to find him in his wood and bring him down." Then Tristan went out to find Urgan in his lair, and they fought hard and long, till courage conquered strength, and Tristan, having cut off the giant's hand, bore it back to the duke. "And, sire," said he, "since I may choose a reward according to your word, give me the little fairy dog. It was for that I conquered Urgan, and your promise stands." "Friend," said the duke, "take it then, but in taking it you take away also all my joy." Then Tristan took the little fairy dog, and gave it in ward to a Welsh harper, who was cunning, and who bore it to Cornwall till he came to Tintagel, and having come there put it secretly into Brangien's hands. And the queen was so pleased that she gave 10 marks of gold to the harper. But she put it about that the queen of Ireland, her mother, had sent the beast, and she had a goldsmith work a little kennel for him, all jewelled and encrusted with gold and enamel inlaid, and wherever she went she carried the dog with her in memory of her friend. And as she watched it, sadness and anguish and regrets melted out of her heart. At first she did not guess the marvel, but thought her consolation was because the gift was Tristan's, till one day she found that it was fairy, and that it was the little bell that charmed her soul. Then she thought, "What have I to do with comfort, since he is sorrowing? He could have kept it too and have forgotten his sorrow, but with high courtesy he sent it to me to give me his joy, and to take up his pain again. Friend, while you suffer, so long will I suffer also." And she took the magic bell and shook it just a little, and then by the open window she threw it into the sea. End of the little fairy bell.
Kind of stinks, no? I mean, she had it, she took it, she tossed it. I mean, I suppose that if you have something magic and you get rid of something magic, I suppose it really does kind of show your devotion to whatever concept it is that you're adhering to. And in this case, it was her solidarity to Tristan. But especially because he got it from the king, who said, "Well, you can have it, but it's the only thing I love." And then Tristan says, "Yeah, I want it." I thought, well, kind of stinks that then she throws it away, but it serves the larger purpose. And the next part is, you won't believe the title of the next one. It's Isolde of the White Hands. Now, I warned you that this was coming, and here it is. There is a second Isolde. I cannot come up with a sane reason for why there are two Isoldes in the same story, except it is possible that there were two competing Tristan and Isolde stories, and somewhere along the line they got smashed together, and this is the way they smashed together, is one came first and then one came second. It is also possible that someone thought the irony of having a second Isolde in a situation like this would be heartbreaking, or I don't know. I don't think irony was invented when these things were being said in the oral tradition, but here we are with two Isoldes. Tristan is going to get himself into trouble in this one, and it's hard not to feel bad for him. And again, this version of the Tristan and Isolde story maintains their love, so they never actually lose touch with the power of the wine that they drank. They're never put in a position where they have to choose to stay in love or fall out of love, where they have to choose to continue the affair. There's never an ethical dilemma. It is merely that their souls are joined and they are in love forever. So for Tristan, this is actually quite a sad chapter. And this is actually chapter 13 out of 15. So this one is also only about, well, it's a little over 10 minutes long. So here we go with Isolde of the White Hands.
Apart, the lovers could neither live nor die, for it was life and death together, and Tristan fled his sorrow through seas and islands and many lands. He fled his sorrow still by seas and islands, till at last he came back to his land of Lyonesse, and there Rohalt, the keeper of faith, welcomed him with happy tears and called him son. But he could not live in the peace of his own land, and he turned again and rode through kingdoms and through baronies, seeking adventure. From the Lyonesse to the lowlands, from the lowlands on to the Germanies, through the Germanies and into Spain, and many lords he served and many deeds did. But for 2 years no news came to him out of Cornwall, nor friend nor messenger. Then he thought that Isolde had forgotten. Now it happened one day that, riding with Gorvenal alone, he came into the land of Brittany. They rode through a wasted plain of ruined walls and empty hamlets and burnt fields everywhere, and the earth deserted of men. And Tristan thought, "I am weary, and my deeds profit me nothing. My lady is far off, and I shall never see her again. Or why for 2 years has she made no sign, and why has she sent no messenger to find me as I wandered? But in Tintagel Mark honours her, and she gives him joy. And that little fairy bell has done a thorough work, for little she remembers or cares for the joys and the mourning of old, little for me, as I wander in this desert place. I too will forget." On the third day, at the hour of noon, Tristan and Gorvenal came near a hill, where an old chantry stood, and close by a hermitage also. And Tristan asked what wasted land that was, and the hermit answered, "Lord, it is Breton land which Duke Hod holds, and once it was rich in pasture and ploughland, but Count Riol of Nantes has wasted it, for you must know that this Count Riol was the Duke's vassal. And the Duke has a daughter, fair among all kings' daughters, and Count Riol would have taken her to wife, but her father refused her to a vassal, and Count Riol would have carried her away by force. Many men have died in that quarrel." And Tristan asked, "Can the Duke wage his war?" And the hermit answered, "Hardly, my lord, yet his last keep of Carhaix holds out still, for the walls are strong, and strong is the heart of the Duke's son, Kaerdin, a very good knight and bold. But the enemy surrounds them on every side and starves them. Very hardly do they hold their castle." Then Tristan asked, "How far is this keep of Carhaix?" "Sir," said the hermit, "it is but 2 miles further on this way." Then Tristan and Gouvernail lay down, for it was evening. In the morning, when they had slept, and when the hermit had chanted, and had shared his black bread with them, Tristan thanked him, and rode hard to Carhaix. And as he halted beneath the fast high walls, he saw a little company of men behind the battlements, and he asked if the Duke was there with his son Kaerdin. Now Hod was among them, and when he cried, "Yes," Tristan called up to him and said, "I am that Tristan, King of Lyonesse, and Mark of Cornwall is my uncle. I have heard that your vassals do you a wrong, and I have come to offer you my arms." "Alas, Lord Tristan, go you your way alone, and God reward you. For here within we have no more food, no wheat or meat or any stores, but only lentils and a little oats remaining." But Tristan said, "For 2 years I dwelt in a forest, eating nothing save roots and herbs. Yet I found it a good life, so open you the door." They welcomed him with honour, and Kaerdin showed him the wall and the dungeon keep with all their devices, and from the battlements he showed the plain, where far away gleamed the tents of Duke Riol. And when they were down in the castle again, he said to Tristan, "Friend, let us go to the hall where my mother and sister sit." So, holding each other's hands, they came into the women's room, where the mother and the daughter sat together weaving gold upon English cloth and singing a weaving song. They sang of Doette the Fair, who sits alone beneath the white thorn, and round about her blows the wind. She waits for Dune, her friend, but he tarries long and does not come. This was the song they sang, and Tristan bowed to them, and they to him. Then Kaerdin, showing the work his mother did, said, "See, friend Tristan, what a workwoman is here, and how marvellously she adorns stoles and chasubles for poor minsters, and how my sister's hands run thread of gold upon this cloth. Of right, good sister, are you called Iseult of the White Hands." But Tristan, hearing her name, smiled and looked at her more gently. And on the morrow Tristan, Kaerdin, and 12 young knights left the castle and rode to a pine wood near the enemy's tents, and sprang from ambush and captured a wagon of Count Riol's food. And from that day, by escapade and ruse, they would carry tents and convoys and kill off men, nor ever come back without some booty, so that Tristan and Kaerdin began to be brothers in arms, and kept faith and tenderness, as history tells. And as they came back from these rides, talking chivalry together, often did Kaerdin praise to his comrade, his sister, Iseult of the White Hands, for her simplicity and beauty. One day, as the dawn broke, a sentinel ran from the tower through the halls, crying, "Lords, you have slept too long. Rise, for an assault is on." And knights and burgesses armed and ran to the walls, and saw helmets shining on the plain, and pennons streaming crimson like flames, and all the host of Riol in its array. Then the Duke and Kaerdin deployed their horsemen before the gates, and from a bow length off they stooped and spurred and charged, and they put their lances down together, and the arrows fell on them like April rain. Now Tristan had armed himself among the last of those the sentinel had roused, and he laced his shoes of steel, and put on his mail and his spurs of gold, his hauberk and his helm over the gorget, and he mounted and spurred, with shield on breast, crying, "Carhaix!" And as he came, he saw Duke Riol charging, rein free, at Kaerdin, but Tristan came in between. So they met, Tristan and Duke Riol, and at the shock, Tristan's lance shivered, but Riol's lance struck Tristan's horse just where the breastpiece runs, and laid it on the field. But Tristan, standing, drew his sword, his burnished sword, and said, "Coward! Here is death ready for the man that strikes the horse before the rider." But Riol answered, "I think you have lied, my lord," and he charged him. and as he passed, Tristan let fall his sword so heavily upon his helm that he carried away the crest and the nasal. But the sword slipped on the mailed shoulder, and glanced on the horse, and killed it, so that of force Duke Riol must slip the stirrup, and leap and feel the ground. Then Riol too was on his feet, and they both fought hard in their broken mail, their scutcheons torn, and their helmets loosened, and lashing with their dented swords, till Tristan struck Riol just where the helmet buckles, and it yielded, and the blow was struck so hard that the baron fell on hands and knees. But when he had risen again, Tristan struck him down once more with a blow that split the helm, and it split the headpiece too, and touched the skull. Then Riol cried mercy and begged his life, and Tristan took his sword. So he promised to enter Duke Hoel's keep, and to swear homage again, and to restore what he had wasted. And by his order the battle ceased, and his host went off discomfited. Now when the victors were returned, Kaerdyn said to his father, "Sire, keep you Tristan. There is no better knight, and your land has need of such courage." So when the Duke had taken counsel with his barons, he said to Tristan, "Friend, I owe you my land, but I shall be quit with you if you will take my daughter, Isoude of the White Hands, who comes of kings and of queens, and of dukes before them in blood." And Tristan answered, "I will take her, sire." So the day was fixed, and the Duke came with his friends and Tristan with his, and before all, at the gate of the minster, Tristan wed Isoude of the White Hands, according to the church's law. But that same night, as Tristan's valets undressed him, it happened that in drawing his arm from his sleeve, they drew off and let fall from his finger the ring of green jasper, the ring of Isoude the Fair. It sounded on the stones, and Tristan looked and saw it. Then his heart awoke, and he knew that he had done wrong, for he remembered the day when Isoude the Fair had given him the ring. It was in that forest where, for his sake, she had led the hard life with him, and that night he saw again the hut in the wood of Morroy, and he was bitter with himself that ever he had accused her of treason, for now it was he that had betrayed, and he was bitter with himself also in pity for this new wife and her simplicity and beauty. See how these two Isoudes had met him in an evil hour, and to both had he broken faith. Now Isoude of the White Hands said to him, hearing him sigh, "Dear lord, have I hurt you in anything? Will you not speak me a single word?" But Tristan answered, "Friend, do not be angry with me, for once in another land I fought a foul dragon and was near to death, and I thought of the Mother of God, and I made a vow to her that, should I ever wed, I would spend the first holy nights of my wedding in prayer and in silence." "Why," said Isoude, "that was a good vow," and Tristan watched through the night. End of Isoude of the White Hands.
Heartbreaking, no? Poor Tristan. I mean, heartbreaking on a lot of levels. Heartbreaking for Isoude of the White Hands, because this isn't her fault. Heartbreaking for Tristan, because here he can't even, after all this time, he can't even think about being married to someone else, and he's gotten himself into it, and now he's kind of stuck. It's very sad. It's very, very sad. Next week we will end Tristan and Isoude, as I said, but before I go tonight, I have a special treat for you from Deb, whose daughter Kate was our interviewee on Courtly Love and Tristan and Isoude, and whose son will soon be an interviewee of ours on Frankenstein. At some point, we're going to get all of Deb's family involved in the podcast, because they all seem to know a lot about a lot of things. But Deb is in a parody band, and they sing parody songs. And one of the parody songs that they sang was Tristan the Knight So Brave, to the song, to the tune of Twistin' the Night Away. So without any further ado, I am going to play you a song.
Tristan's Uncle Mark the King gave him an engagement ring. mission was an easy thing. Deliver it across the waves. The ring was for the very soul who Mark proposed to have and hold. With eyes of blue, a hair of gold, like Tristan the knight so brave. Tristan, barely old enough to shave. Tristan, the knight so brave. She came aboard at Erin's port. Tristan was a sole escort, built safe inside of Cornwall's fort. To guard her till she made a grave, she bought a potion as a lark. Then for her an old King Mark, instead it would ignite a spark. In Tristan the knight so brave. Tristan, wasn't anybody's slave. Tristan, the knight so brave. One morning while they were at sail, they drank what they had thought was ale. Then watched as their resistance failed and made them act as if depraved. The drink left nothing up to chance, for love was what it would enhance. His old she did the dirty dance with Tristan the knight so brave. Tristan didn't like to misbehave. Tristan the knight so brave. His old and Marcus knew her well, although she loved his knight instead, and stole away to Tristan's bed. By passion they were both enslaved. Soon it seems his soul was missed, and Mark discovered Tristan's tryst. And so the king got awful pissed at Tristan the knight so brave. Tristan, and his lover ran away. Tristan, the knight so brave. Tristan, never even stopped to wave. Tristan, the knight so brave.
It occurs to me that if I had had that earlier, we could have just listened to that and not had to listen to the story at all. It pretty much summarizes nicely the main plot points. And I'm really thrilled with the rhyme. I just keep cracking myself up every time I listen to that. And on that whole note of cracking myself up, I have a joke for you. This joke comes from our Australian friend Spidernet, and she said, I meant to email you with this when I listened to the podcast. This is from 2 weeks ago. Your discussion of Ireland being the place you go when you die reminded me of a joke I first heard a couple of years ago. And the joke goes like this. A young Australian does what many young Australians do. He leaves on a grand tour of Europe. On this trip, he sees something unusual. In a cathedral in the UK, he sees a plain white telephone on the wall of the cathedral near the font. It has a simple label stating a value of £2,000. He thinks this is a little odd, but he leaves the phone alone. He continues to travel and starts to see these simple white phones in many large religious buildings. The prices vary slightly from place to place, but it's always in the local currency and always a lot of money. After a long and enjoyable year of travel, he heads home for his sister's wedding. The wedding is beautiful, and it's held in a local chapel of his hometown. After the service, he notices a plain white telephone, and the label there says 20 cents. He is staggered, and his curiosity gets the better of him. He pulls aside the kindly old priest and asks him what the phone is for. The priest says, "It's a direct line to God, my son." And the man says, "But I traveled all over the world, and it was always thousands of dollars to use the phone. Why is it only 20 cents here?" "Ah, my son, you're back in Australia. It's a local call." I have a number of friends in Australia, and I think they would all agree with that. I hope someday to manage to make it to Australia, but it's going to take some time, I think. And it's certainly going to take some time when I don't have small children with me. My mom is, however, in Italy right now, and I am mad jealous, yo. She's in Rome for some meetings and claims that she's going to come home with postcards and, and pictures. But somehow it's just not going to be the same as having the wine and the coffee. It's all about liquids for me. The food was great, but it was the wine and the coffee. And the milk. God, the milk was great. Oh well. C'est la guerre. I think that's it for this week. Don't forget, if you donate during the month of September, you are put into a drawing for sock yarn from Cheeky Redhead, or for a craftlet charm from our friend and artist Jen Minnis. There will, I hope, be a new t-shirt available for you soon with our Hot Men of Craftlet. Please don't forget what crestfallen really means. If you haven't started reading the Thursday Next books by Jasper Ford, really, you must. I hope you have a great week. I hope you don't catch my cold, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you once again to Knitting Out Loud for sponsoring our program. Please make sure to support the companies and people who support Craftlit. You can find a blog for this podcast at craftlit.blogspot.com. or craftlit.libsyn.com. That's craftlit, C-R-A-F-T-L-I-T, all one word, and Libsyn, L-I-B-S-Y-N. And of course, you can subscribe at iTunes. Craftlit is supported by the generous donations of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And do remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.